With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Farm technology and a robot parade draws crowds in Salinas. The autonomous agriculture industry and some 1,500 visitors came to the Salinas Sports Complex last week to meet the farm robots of today and tomorrow. The September FIRA USA gathering matched agriculture technology inventors with growers and venture capitalists. It featured researchers and graduate students from around the world presenting their findings in lightning talks, and it also drew crowds for farm technology demonstrations, including a farm robot parade. The Salinas Valley is taking a leading role in pioneering agriculture technology. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Tulare County Crop Report shows big increases. The Tulare County Ag Commissioner released its annual Crop and Livestock Value Report, which highlighted the increase of more than $5 million worth of goods. Tulare County's total gross agricultural production value for 2022 is $8,612,450,000. That's 6.5% above 2021's value of $8,089,621,300. The 2022 crop report covers more than 150 different commodities, 41 of which have a gross value in excess of $1 million. The top producing commodity is milk, with a gross value of just over $2.6 billion. That value is an increase of 37% from 2021, and this amount represents 31% of the total crop and livestock value for the county. Other report mentionables include field crop production value in 2022 had an increase of 30% from the previous year. That's due in part to better prices for field crops across the board. Fruit and nut commodities combined were valued at $4,127,035,000, which is a decrease of 10% from 2021. This decrease can be partially attributed to a decrease in the value of lemons, peaches, tangerines, and walnuts. Vegetable crops were valued at $26,604,000, representing an increase of nearly 30%, and this can be attributed to the increase in harvested acreage for a variety of vegetables. Tulare, Kings, Kern, and Fresno counties continue to be the state's top producing regions that provide food to more than 90 countries around the world. And now here's AgNet West Brian German with more agriculture news.
The Global Harvest Automation Initiative is continuing to make strides in helping advance new automation technologies. While at the recent FIRA USA event in Salinas, Western Growers Vice President of Innovation, Walt Duflock, explained some of the recent progress that's been made, which should allow for more rapid development of ag tech equipment.
So we continue to try and build tools that all the startups can use so that they can speed up their time to first product. So we've got an image library now where you can start with a set of 500 high quality images that are vetted out of 10,000. They're tagged, they're downloaded, they're ready to go, they're open sourced. So you as a strawberry startup, for example, can come to this image library at AgML, download our image library for that crop. You're not finding an engineer, hiring them, building an image library, machine capture yourself, and then doing that. You just download the images, you're ready to go with R&D and prototyping on day one. That's been huge. About 400 users have used that. And then we've got a toolkit, a startup toolkit, where there's so many startups because we've got so much more venture capital than we used to have. We can't have them talking to all of them talking to growers. What we do is we put them through the toolkit, and this is now being used by the industry as a starting point to say, before you go see a grower, go do your homework on the toolkit. Understand the grower use cases, understand the problems, understand what they need to solve, and biggest of all, understand the economics they need to meet. Otherwise, you'll never get there.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, speaking at the recent 2023 Ag Outlook Forum, U.S. Congressman Tracy Mann and U.S. Congresswoman Charisse Davids, both of Kansas, were asked if a controversy over SNAP benefits can be expected in the Farm Bill debate.
Yes, there will be controversy. I mean, that is not... When you look at where agreement is or is not, there is still, I would say, disagreement on behalf of some members of Congress. I'm going to speak for everybody on what those levels are. So I think that continues to be part of the conversation. And when it's 81% of the funding, how would it not be? Right. So it's just when you talk about the Farm Bill, 81% now is on the food nutrition side. Whether those amounts are where they should be or not, that's for Congress to decide. But I definitely think those conversations will continue here moving forward.
Do you want to speak to that? Or
Only in that I had, maybe this is my being a little bit naive because it's my first farm bill. And not just like on the Ag Committee, it's my first farm bill. In like the big picture even, is that I had hoped that when we passed the Fiscal Responsibility Act that it would just mean that there would be a little less, because there were some of the additional work requirements and that sort of thing in the Fiscal Responsibility Act that I had hoped that at least that would get us through the Farm Bill reauthorization. But I mean, it's a perennial argument that happens between, and it's also not even just an argument between Democrats and Republicans. It's like some of it is some Democrats want to see much higher funding, and so there's intra-party dynamics that are at play for even for the nutrition programs as well. So it's not, it's not surprising that there's going to constantly be an argument. I just had hoped that in this Congress, with the Fiscal Responsibility Act, that it would be maybe tamped down a little bit.
The lawmakers were also asked about reference prices. Congresswoman Davids admitted it's a new topic for her.
Whatever ends up happening in the negotiation with reference pricing, there's a couple of things that I can tell you I'm going to do. Like, first, I'm going to call like the Farm Bureau folks that I've been visiting with and talk to a bunch of the folks who are from the different commodity groups too, and in this region. And then I've already actually talked to Rep Mann. I was going to say Tracy, but I feel like I should
Tracy.
Call you the judge. Okay. About making sure that I understand what the impact of any changes on reference pricing would be statewide, because of the just recognizing that there's, he has more than half the state, I think. So. Yeah, just trying to make sure that I have a good understanding, because the last thing I want to do is anything that would be a detriment to our region and to Kansas farmers.
Real quick on that. So I would just say we got to acknowledge, there's a farm safety net out there, and it was set up 5 years ago to be a certain height off the floor, call it 3 feet. And that's, reference prices played in all these programs. It was, built to withstand a fall off of a 10-foot fall. If you double input costs and you're falling from 20 feet, you could still be a producer, do everything right, hit the safety net, and still hit the ground and do serious damage. And so I think reference prices are in the context of this overall conversation of where should the safety net be and what's the appropriate height off the ground to maximize production in this country, and that's the conversation that will continue.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, the U.S. Meat Export Federation recently hosted a trade seminar in Shanghai. It was aimed at showcasing the value and versatility offered by U.S. beef and pork cuts. John Harith has more details.
More than 250 representatives of the Chinese meat industry gathered recently in Shanghai at the invitation of the U.S. Meat Export Federation to look at new convenience items featuring U.S. beef and pork. According to USMEF President and CEO Dan Hallstrom, the seminar was designed to show the versatility of U.S. products for home meal replacement and restaurant meal replacement kits.
Just some options both for retail brick and mortar store business as well as the online e-commerce business for delivery. Some of the items we showed, for example, was the jerky meat made from outside round on the beef side. And on the loin side, we showed some center of the plate pork loin options from meal kits. And all this was designed for satisfying that demand on the convenience side.
The Chinese market, and particularly tourism, has not yet rebounded from COVID, putting a short-term focus on home meals with longer-term prospects for growth coming from restaurant business eventually coming back.
As compared to pre-COVID in China, the consumer is much more conservative. There's still a concern on the sickness front with COVID. So yes, I think there will be a tendency, at least the short to medium term, to continue to consume a higher percentage of meals at home versus out in the restaurants. I would estimate that that would change over time or shift a bit, but no doubt that's an opportunity today. And that was part of the reason for the seminar, was to give the trade some of these ideas on value-added options, be it in-store HMR options or even online options, e-commerce options to deliver at home some of these meal kits and restaurant meal replacement options. And the feedback from the attendees was very positive about some of these ideas.
The trade seminar was made possible through support from USDA, the Beef Checkoff Program, the National Pork Board, and the United Soybean Board. For more, please visit USMEF.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm John Harith.
Thanks, John. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture recently placed restrictions on the importation of poultry from France and the European Union. The restrictions, enacted by USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, include live ducks, duck eggs, and unmitigated or untreated duck products from the APHIS-recognized European poultry trade region, as well as Iceland, Switzerland, and Norway, but excluded Great Britain. The restrictions are due to increased risk of introducing high pathogenic avian influenza into the U.S. and were enacted October 1st. The restrictions are based on the World Organization for Animal Health's definition of poultry and result from France's decision to vaccinate commercial meat ducks against HPAI. France's decision to vaccinate presents a risk of introducing HPAI into the U.S. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
October 12th is National Farmers Day, a time dedicated to those who wake before the sun rises and often work until long after it sets. Thanks to farmers' tireless efforts, we have the food, feed, fiber, and fuel we need here in America and plenty more for export. Best of all, farmers produce all of this sustainably so that future generations can have the same bounty. Today and every day, please join Syngenta in honoring the men and women of American agriculture.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
The farm real estate market is holding steady. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. As combines roll into the fields this fall, there's a renewed sense of optimism when looking at the real estate market. The current state of the ag land market is resilient, and the demand for high-quality farmland remains strong in the face of higher interest rates and lower commodity prices, that according to Farmers National Company. However, the market will likely return to a more normal flow, evidenced by the slowdown of the appreciation rate of ag land, as well as the sales volume at Farmers National Company. Regional drought pressures across portions of the Corn Belt have also softened short-term demand for land. Areas highly impacted by the drought have seen seasonal pressure, with the lowest quality farms impacted the most, while demand for higher quality land has remained stable. The solid demand for ag properties from people interested in expanding their farm operations or investment opportunities seems to be driving the interest in high quality cropland. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. C corporations can provide tax-free benefits to a greater extent than other entity types. One of those involves meals and lodging. The rules have changed in recent years, but it still can be a good tax break in the right situation. The value of meals and lodging furnished in kind to employees on the business premises for the employer's convenience and as a condition of employment is not taxable income to the employee and is deductible by the employer. Likewise, the value of meals and lodging furnished on the business premises for the convenience of the employer are not wages for FICA and FUTA purposes. For the value of lodging to be excluded, the employee must be required to accept the lodging on the premises as a condition of employment, such as for security reasons, livestock observation, or periodic chores. The lodging must be provided in kind. Cash allowances for lodging and meals for compensation aren't excludable. Historically, cash grain operations have had the greatest difficulty in successfully excluding the cost of lodging and meals provided by the corporation to employees. On the other hand, livestock ventures or those that are irrigating or drying grain typically have had better success against an IRS challenge. Currently, meals provided to a harvest crew and meals provided in employer housing are 50% deductible through 2025. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
A recap of a recent USDA-led agricultural trade mission provided by Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs, Alexis Taylor.
In addition to having our businesses meet with Chilean buyers, we also have brought in buyers from Peru and Ecuador to really be able to maximize what this region has to offer.
The Undersecretary was the head of the U.S. delegation during the week-long mission to Chile, joined by various agribusiness, commodity marketing organization, and state agriculture department and commission representatives.
It is the third largest market for U.S. food and agricultural exports in South America, and we have strong bilateral trade with Chile. Bilaterally in food and ag space, we are trading $8.5 billion in 2022. $1.1 billion of that is U.S. food and agricultural exports, with about 60% of those exports consumer-oriented products.
Some of those U.S. food and farm goods in demand by Chilean consumers include
high-value protein products like dairy, beef, pork, poultry. We also send quite a lot of condiments, and turns out the largest importer of U.S. beer in the world is Chile.
During the mission, at approximate 350 business-to-business meetings were held between potential buyers and trade mission delegates. Among State Agriculture Department representatives participating, North Dakota Ag Commissioner Doug Gehring and Colorado Ag Commissioner Kate Greenberg. They offered their thoughts on the recent ag trade mission.
This has been a great opportunity to really work on the relationships, our rapport, and build a better understanding and appreciation for the Chilean culture, but also areas in where we can complement each other, given the fact that our growing seasons are opposite of each other.
Seeing opportunities for us, for our Colorado producers, especially beef, dairy, beverages, consumer-facing products, that we've seen the opportunities here, but also what we can take home and see as complementary from our Chilean partners as well.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air,
your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
The path of least resistance continues lower for grains and for the stock market. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report at midweek, brought to you by Kloss Equipment. Maximize your harvest potential with the reliability, the efficiency, and affordability of the Kloss Treon 740 Combine. Take a closer look at Kloss.com. Investor sentiment on Wall Street has been termed dampened as traders are taking the position that the recent agreement to keep the government open did nothing to address major disagreements, and we're headed for another shutdown fight later this year. And as one analyst said, lawmakers will continue to simply push the can down the road and push this whole issue into an election year. The Dow breached 34,000 on September 28th. The last time it closed below 33,000 was on March 29th. We look to be headed that direction. If not this week, we think perhaps next week. This is the Bottom Line Report. Five more cargo ships headed to Ukrainian ports to load grain after three left last week and left safely. There's not a lot of positive news anywhere in the grain trade, and as mentioned, the path of least resistance continues lower. That's our bottom line at midweek. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
An ag economics expert says this year's Farm Bill battle is a repeat of bills gone by. During a recent Farm Foundation online forum, Dr. Joe Outlaw with the Food and Ag Policy Center at Texas A&M stressed that farm bills have a hard history.
We've done this, 90-plus years, and they've never been easy.
He says during his career, he's seen similarities through the years.
In general, the Democrats have been really supportive of food programs and conservation programs, not that they don't support the other side, the Title I, the producer payments. But when you tend to have different groups saying that they want to protect certain areas, like in general, over my 40-year career, basically, Republicans have been really focused on the safety net, Title I specifically.
And he pointed out that farm bills are crafted for when times are tough. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And in more agriculture news, registration is officially open for the 105th American Farm Bureau Convention. And this year, it's going to be held in Salt Lake City, Utah. Chad Smith has more on the convention, which will have a theme of new frontiers.
The American Farm Bureau's 2024 convention is January 19th through the 24th in Salt Lake City, Utah. Nikki Jones, Director of Event Marketing for IDEA Ag, talks about what attendees can expect in 2024.
Well, attendees will get unique insights on the policies and perspectives that will affect farms, ranches, and agribusinesses in 2024. There will be inspiring keynote speakers, an innovative trade show event, and exclusive ag industry workshops. Attendees will walk away prepped for the year ahead in agriculture.
She says there are a lot of reasons farmers and ranchers should attend the convention.
Attendees can expect to be educated and inspired by the workshops at convention. We're hosting 20 workshops on industry issues presented by ag experts from across the country. Workshops are exclusive to convention attendees only, and topics range across four tracks: public policy, rural development, member engagement, and consumer engagement. Also, don't forget the opportunities available to tour Salt Lake City and the state of Utah with the Ag Tours.
Jones talks about how farmers and ranchers can get more information and sign up online.
You can go to annualconvention.fb.org to learn more about the event. There's a link to registration from the website, or members are encouraged to contact their state farm bureaus for additional details.
Once again, that's annualconvention.fb.org. Chad Smith, Washington.
As autumn is now underway, so is the transition of the change of color in many of our nation's forest lands. But perhaps you wonder as you visit your local forest or take a drive to see fall colors, what causes the change from the greens of spring and summer to the golds and reds of fall? U.S. Forest Service plant physiologist Paul Schottberg starts by explaining,
not all species turn or have the capability of turning red in the fall,
which goes beyond evergreens and various deciduous trees. For instance, maples and white ash foliage can turn various shades of red, while leaves on species like cottonwood and birch transform only to yellow. And that leads to understanding that leaves, in essence, only have three pigments of color.
The green, which is chlorophyll, which helps trees capture light to make food energy, sugars. Then there's the yellow carotenoids, which also help the leaves capture light, but also have a protective influence. And finally, there's the red anthocyanins. And those have a protective function primarily. Indeed, they've been called the Swiss Army knife of plant protective compounds because they have so many protective qualities.
The chlorophyll that gives leaves its green colors starts to fade come the shorter days of fall, giving way to existing yellow protective compounds. Then there is the third, red pigment.
With minor stresses in the fall, they are produced as a new compound when the leaves are actually going to be starting to senesce.
Odd, in that the tree is using sugars and nutrients to build the red pigments in dying leaves. Forest Service research of this phenomenon indicates,
because these are protective compounds, they are produced in only some tree species to help protect the leaves to stay on the tree a little longer so that it can reabsorb the remaining sugars and nutrients that are in those leaves.
In part, for use in development of next year's leaves. Now, how best to observe fall colors, whether you visit woodlands close by or far away. U.S. Forest Service plant physiologist Kevin Smith says it is not just about the trees with foliage that change color.
View the foliage in areas that have some topographic relief, hills and valleys. The timing of color can vary from hilltop to the valley. You can get sort of a Persian rug effect of details of the mosaic of color when you have a little bit of elevation.
Smith adds that forest composition, in part based on land use, also plays a role in what one sees in the fall color portrait.
Having a mixed deciduous and some pine or hemlock mixed in, coniferous trees that retain their green needles for some period of time, that having that green mix in is interesting visually along with the color.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
GMOs? Genetically engineered? Bioengineered? What's what? Well, GMO stands for genetically modified organism. It's the common term many people use for foods created through a process scientists call genetic engineering. And you'll start seeing bioengineered on some food packages to let you know the product or some of its ingredients come from GMOs. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the show. Yesterday, the Department of Water Resources held a Water Year media briefing, which I happened to be a part of, where several water experts shared insight on the year to come, and they also took a look back at one of the wettest water years on record. And while I'll be sharing much of what I gathered from the briefing and coming shows, I did want to highlight a couple different comments from DWR Director Carla Nemeth, with this first comment on the bigger water picture.
So big picture, this was as close to a miracle year as you can get after following just the intensity of drought conditions. I think surprised a lot of folks until we maybe got to mid-December last year. If you remember, we were all very much girding for a fourth La Nina year. And that, frankly, speaks to a lot of work that we need to do, in particular at the federal level, to improve our forecasting capabilities, because it's just very clear that the sooner we know, the more options we have to really plan for these kinds of conditions. But truly a miracle year. One, just in terms of the amount of precipitation and the intensity of the snowpack, but also in many respects, a miracle year because we had such a long and mild spring and summer that enabled that snowpack to stay put and enabled water managers and flood agencies to, and certainly our partners at the Corps in the Tulare Basin, to manage that amount of snowmelt in about as safe a way as we could have anticipated. Certainly points us in a direction of lots more work to do to be ready with our existing infrastructure, ready for additional infrastructure that can move water in volume to these recharge areas. So that is the future. And then maybe lastly, I'll say, Haley, one of the things that Dr. Anderson and others are tracking is, we've always had intense variability in California, but the suddenness of the shift from very extreme dry to very extreme wet is something that we think needs additional research to understand how climate changes in the climate may have played a factor or not in that extreme shift.
And here is Nemeth with three takeaways from last year as California prepares for a possible consecutive wet water season.
So three lessons learned is that people are ready for recharge, particularly in the Central Valley. We have to get more ready. But a lot of folks, because of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, they know they need to be identifying and establishing recharge areas. So I think that was a terrific lesson learned from last year. I think that particularly in the Tulare Basin, we learned that there is an enormous value to regional flood planning, simply as a communication tool for smaller communities, because we know that you can't build your way out of any flooding. We all sort of take those risks, living in society and how we want to protect our communities. But what's enormously important when we do have big flood conditions are communications with communities and, our collective ability to have organized regional flood planning that is then communicated to local communities so that they know what to do to keep themselves safe is essential. So I think that was a lesson learned last year. And then, maybe it's simply because of my station at the moment as the director of the California Department of Water Resources, I often find myself reflecting on when Mother Nature really helps us out. She did help us out in a really, really big way in certain parts of the state. Other parts along the coast had some real challenges, and the time is now to get that infrastructure, the flood infrastructure, ready to go. But we were extremely fortunate, really, throughout the state, throughout the Sierra, with the slower kind of graduation of the snowmelt. And we should not, I think the lesson there is, we all have a tendency to say, well, we survived that. We survived 400% snowpack conditions generally. But there are always ways in which Mother Nature can throw us a curveball, and we shouldn't expect that necessarily again. So there's a lot of work to continue to be done, particularly when it comes to flooding and protecting our communities.
You're listening to AgNet NewsHour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. Legislation will require crop insurance transparency. Looking for less secrecy in the crop insurance program, Representatives Earl Blumener of Oregon and Ralph Norman of South Carolina introduced the Crop Insurance Transparency Act. If passed, it would require USDA to publicly disclose the names of producers and insurers who receive federal crop insurance subsidies and the amount received. Blumener says, quote, "At the time when federal crop insurance payments are at an all-time high, it's an abject failure that a majority of our small farmers and ranchers do not even have access to the crop insurance safety net. Reform begins with accurate and transparent information." Norman adds that one-third of all crop insurance subsidies don't make it to farmers but instead go to massive insurance companies. Scott Faber of the Environmental Working Group says, quote, "Millionaires and billionaires are likely receiving crop insurance subsidies at a time when most farmers are struggling to get by. It's time to lift the veil of secrecy." An AFB contributed to that report.
USDA is expecting high levels of production for American tree nuts, but prices are another story. USDA economic researcher Seth Wechsler said the story for 2023 is that production is up, but prices are down significantly. Walnut acreage decreased as prices are historically low, however, at the same time, domestic production will tie the record set in 2020. Wechsler went on to describe the outlook for U.S. almonds.
We see about a 1.5% increase in production. This is going to be just about the third largest production on record at 2.6 billion pounds or so. The main factor driving increases in aggregate production are increases in bearing acreage. Now, there was some stormy and temperate weather this spring and some variable growing conditions which depressed yields. But these adverse weather conditions or unfavorable weather conditions weren't sufficiently adverse to offset gains associated with having more land in production.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
USDA says lower-income countries spend more on food. Consumers in low-income countries spend a greater portion of their budgets on food than those in higher-income countries. That's according to USDA's Economic Research Service. As incomes rise with economic development and urbanization, the share of the income spent on food tends to fall. While discretionary spending on household goods, education, medical services, and recreation tends to increase. In low-income African and South Asian countries, spending on food accounted for more than 40% of total consumer expenditures in 2022. This contrasts with higher-income economies in Latin America, including Argentina, Colombia, and Mexico, where an average of about 22.5% of budgets was spent on food. In emerging markets such as Brazil, India, and China, where incomes are rising, the share of discretionary incomes spent on non-food categories increased. In higher-income economies, including the United States, Switzerland, Australia, and Canada, disposable incomes remain larger, and the food share of consumer expenditures is smaller than those in countries where urban communities are still expanding. The National Association of Farm Broadcasters contributed to that report.
The California Department of Water Resources has released the public review draft of the California Water Plan Update 2023. DWR said the update promotes climate change adaptation and strengthens watershed resilience and water equity. Updated every 5 years, the water plan is meant to serve as a comprehensive framework to guide water managers such as water districts, cities, and counties. Updates to the plan are based on a variety of factors, including the water resilience portfolio, community feedback, and overall state needs. DWR is currently in the middle of hosting a two-day hybrid meeting in Roseville that will be wrapping up this afternoon. DWR is encouraging community engagement and is seeking public comment, which can be submitted through email, an online submission form, and through postal mail. The deadline to make a submission is October 19th. More information on how to submit comment is available at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
There's just 1 month left to apply for methane reduction research programs. CDFA is still accepting application proposals for its new 2023 Livestock Enteric Methane Emission Reduction Research Program. The deadline to apply is November 1st. Enteric methane emissions are greenhouse gases produced in the stomachs of livestock and are either exhaled or belched by the animal. In 2020, dairy and livestock enteric methane emissions were responsible for approximately 11 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent per year. That represents 35% of the agriculture and forestry sector's GHG. John R. Tozzel, Senior Director for Global Agriculture Methane from the Environmental Defense Fund, says, quote, "Addressing enteric methane emissions from livestock is key to slowing the rate of climate change. California's investment in enteric emission solutions is a leading example of how to support more resilient livestock systems and a healthier climate collective." California's budget for 2022 provided $9.5 million to fund projects that could potentially reduce enteric methane emissions. This methane reduction research program will award competitive grants to universities, nonprofit research organizations, and California Native American tribes. To learn more information about the process and to apply, you can visit cdfa.ca.gov/OEFI/enteric.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.